count would drag on far longer than anyone expected. On the morning of day two of the extended election period, I walked into a communication strategy meeting to discuss the rhetorical warfare that was beginning between the campaigns. Dan Bartlett said, "We need more spokespeople on the ground in Florida. Any volunteers?" Whereas the Gore campaign had most of its paid communicators at the national headquarters or in Tallahassee, the state capital of Florida, one part of our communication strategy was aimed at spreading paid spokespeople out into select counties of interest. As a couple of hands went up, I thought to myself how worn out I was from traveling and how eagerly I'd been looking forward to a well-deserved rest. But a few more days on the road won't make much difference, I finally concluded. I raised my hand as well. By mid-afternoon, a handful of us spokespeople were on a private jet to be dropped off in different strategic locales around Florida. I had almost no clean clothes left since the end of campaign travel had been nonstop, but I managed to pull together what was wearable. "I just have to get through the weekend," I remember thinking. "Surely it will be over by then." Little did I know that I would not return home to Austin for 3 weeks and that the recount marathon would last 36 days, causing confusion and uproar in newsrooms around the country and unprecedented angst for millions of voters. Starting in Pinellas County near Tampa Bay, I traveled across the central part of the state, reaching Kissimmee, near Orlando, by the end of week one. Then things got particularly interesting when the Gore campaign targeted Broward, Miami-Dade, and Palm Beach counties, each a Democratic stronghold, for manual hand recounts. I remember joining up in Broward with a volunteer organizational team made up of advisors to Ohio Governor Bob Taft. They were there to help make sure tables were staffed with Bush volunteers and that the volunteers understood when and when not to challenge ballots. We coordinated our efforts out of the office of the county GOP chairman, Eddie Pizzulli, who was helping lead the Bush efforts. The machine recount had already been conducted as required by law because of the closeness of the election. Bush remained in the lead. A campaign could request hand recounts, but Broward, like other counties, could order a hand recount only after a vote by the county canvassing board, typically made up of the county judge and two county commissioners. Technically, the canvassing board was supposed to vote for a hand recount only after an initial sampling of precincts had been conducted and there was reason to believe there were errors serious enough to warrant one. Initially, the Broward County Canvassing Board voted against ordering a full hand recount. The Taft volunteers, Pizzulli, and I had a brief celebration that day, thinking the result was final and believing nothing would change. I was dispatched to Miami-Dade County, and by the time I got there, Team Taft from Ohio had arrived as well. The canvassing board there likewise voted against a full hand recount. Another victory, we thought. But then we learned that the Broward Canvassing Board had reversed course under pressure from Democratic trial lawyers enlisted by the Gore campaign. Suddenly, we were headed back to Fort Lauderdale in Broward County. The recount process was moved to a larger venue, the Broward County Hurricane Center. Around 15 or 20 long tables were brought into a large room, so both GOP and Democratic volunteers could sit at the tables and jointly review ballots one by one. The county people knew they were under a time limit to get the ballots reviewed, so they wanted as many tables going as reasonable. If the opposing party volunteers at a table could not agree on the voter intention revealed by the ballot, it would be set aside for the three-member commissioner's court to determine by majority vote. The canvassing board was made up of two Democrats and one Republican. You may remember pictures of the Republican commissioner with his glasses perched on top of his head and eyes wide open, glaring at the ballot as he holds it up to the light. I believe it is around midnight of the first full day of recounting that we discovered a potential issue of concern and a great angle for a news story. Ed McNally, a lawyer who had worked in the first Bush administration and later the second, had come to Broward to help with legal issues. A Bush volunteer approached us just after the hand recount was halted for the day. "There's something over here that you should see," he said. He walked us over to the table he had helped man and pointed to the floor. On the floor were sprinkled a significant number of CHAD. As the world came to learn that month, for voting purposes, a CHAD is a tiny, confetti-like rectangular piece of paper that is made when someone makes a hole in a punch card. A CHAD can take several different forms. A hanging CHAD is connected to the ballot by one of its four corners, a swinging CHAD is attached by two corners, and a tri-CHAD by three corners. Then there is a pregnant or dimpled CHAD that has an indention in it, supposedly from a voter who may have been trying to cast a vote, but the Chad remains attached at all four corners. I never thought I would be a Chad expert, but the 2000 election made Chadology an essential topic. As we stood looking at the tiny bits of paper scattered all over the floor, Ed came up with a clever idea. "These Chad could be considered evidence of a crime," he said. "If people had been handling the ballots too much or too carelessly, or, worse yet, if they'd been deliberately poking pieces of Chad out of the ballots to alter the election results, that could explain why so much confetti was littering the floor." The local Democratic leaders had already dispersed for the night. We sought out the local election official still present as the ballot boxes were being secured in the back room, which bore a large glass window on the entrance side. A sheriff's deputy was present to guard the room. At our request, the election official ordered the fallen Chad on the floor to be collected and placed in a large envelope marked Crime Scene Evidence. Our campaign and supporters had already questioned the integrity of the hand recounts, given that the ballots were now being handled yet again after being put through a machine twice. The wear and tear of multiple handlings, we contended, could be altering the votes or knocking Chad loose. Now we had evidence to back up our claim. After consulting with Ed, I quietly went around to reporters individually the next morning to alert them of the previous night's development. "Did you hear about what happened last night?" I asked. When they replied they had not, I explained. "They, election officials, seized a bunch of fallen Chad late last night," I said. "You ought to ask to see the envelope they put them in." I knew that, in the heated atmosphere of Florida 2000, an envelope marked Crime Scene Evidence would make for great pictures. I also coordinated a news conference with Eddie Pizzulli. Eddie did a great job, standing outside the building with the words Hurricane Center plainly visible, talking about how Hurricane Chad hit Broward County last night, and raising questions about the integrity of the whole hand recount process. Just as we hoped, the news coverage added to the nation's doubts about the legitimacy of the recount. A couple of days later, I was sent to nearby Palm Beach County, where a hand count was also underway. I took a clear plastic bag filled with more fallen Chad from the second night. The election officials turned down our request to seize another batch of fallen Chad, so we did it ourselves, and marked the bag with the words Fallen Chad, Broward County, and the number of paper fragments, well over 100, that we'd picked up off the carpet and tables. I held up the bag when I arrived in Palm Beach County for assembled reporters and again raised questions about the process. Mark Roscoe, the Montana governor and Bush advisor, went out on the Sunday political shows that week. At his request, I sent him the bag of fallen Chad. He referred to it as clear and compelling evidence of the completely untrustworthy hand recounting process. Personally, I viewed the recount process as selective, unfair, and sometimes wacky, allowing canvassing boards that were majority Democratic to decide the fate of disputed ballots based on what they believed voter intent to be did not strike me as particularly objective. In Palm Beach County, when the canvassing board was running up against the deadline to finish its hand recount, our lead lawyer on the ground there, John Bolton, named American ambassador to the UN in Bush's second term, and his team, including Florida attorney Mark Wallace, reportedly caught the Democratic commissioner on the board directing sheriff's deputies which specific precinct boxes to bring out for recounting. The problem? The boxes were supposed to be selected randomly, and this commissioner was allegedly telling the deputies to get ones that were considered heavily Democratic and, therefore, most likely to help pick up votes for Gore. Frankly, I believe the Gore campaign made a strategic mistake by not calling for a manual hand recount in every county. That would have been hard to dispute as anything but fair. At any rate, the fallen Chad provided us some great fodder for questioning the selectivity and subjectivity of the hand recounts. But the Florida recount continued for a couple more weeks. No one had ever witnessed anything like it. Certainly nothing in my political background had prepared me for it. I remember as a third grader staying up until 3:30 a.m. to follow the results as my mother won the closest mayoral election in Austin history. That seemed like a rare anomaly to me. Mom later won a re-election by the largest margin ever. On day 21 of the recount ordeal, I was granted a reprieve and allowed to travel home for the weekend. As I was waiting word on whether I needed to return to Florida, Ari Fleischer, who had already been named the transition press secretary, called from Washington to offer me the deputy press secretary position for the transition. He also asked me to be his principal deputy should the Florida results hold. I accepted fairly quickly. Rather than returning to Florida, I headed to Washington to begin work on the transition team. We had a temporary space already set up for our use until Bush was recognized as the official winner and given taxpayer space and funds from the General Services Administration in Washington. My focus shifted quickly to helping Ari with press management and dealing with the multitude of transition issues. When Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris certified Bush the winner in Florida, Dick Cheney was already overseeing the transition out of temporary space near his home in McLean, Virginia, just outside of Washington. He formally requested that the GSA provide us the keys to the government transition office near the White House. The GSA, under White House direction, refused. This did not make Cheney happy. On December 12th, when the Supreme Court made its controversial ruling ending the Florida recount and dispelling questions about the result, the GSA invited the vice president-elect to a press event at the transition office. Still stewing about the initial snub, Cheney had Ari send a lower-level official, me, to receive the keys. The idea was to send the GSA a message. I had no idea what I was supposed to do. When I got to the transition office, I was given a brief tour, then handed the keys in front of a battery of television and still cameras. Although the assembled reporters seemed to expect some sort of speech, I said little other than, "Thank you." I think the GSA got the message from Cheney, and they worked hard to make up for the displeasure they'd caused him from that day forward. Within days, I was standing in my new office behind the briefing room, a barren space with a couple of chairs and a computer. It all happened so quickly that I barely had a chance to absorb the amazing fact that I was now working for the nation's 43rd president in the West Wing of the White House. By and large, Bush and his campaign did a successful job of defining him and starting the process of changing the image of the Republican Party nationally. Bush was elected with a clear agenda: tax cuts, education reform, strengthening Social Security, strong defense, and military transformation. He was also elected with a clear public image as a different kind of Republican, a compassionate conservative who understood and cared about the needs and interests of the middle class, the working class, and the poor, and was willing to use the government when necessary to help meet those needs. As Bush took office, buoyed by the nation's relief over the ending of the prolonged election process, as well as by Al Gore's gracious concession speech, Bush was promising to bring the country a fresh start after a season of cynicism. His intention, it appeared, was to reach across the aisle, as he'd done in Texas, to forge cooperative links with Democrats in Congress and elsewhere in pursuit of goals that would benefit all Americans. The days of endless scandal and partisan warfare in Washington were coming to an end, or so I believed. Events of the months and years to come would test the sincerity of Bush's intention to end the excesses of the permanent campaign era, as well as the depth of his promised commitment to ensuring that every member of his administration adhered to high ethical standards. Chapter 5, The Permanent Campaign. Planning for the Bush transition quietly began more than a year and a half in advance of Election Day. This process was led by the president's trusted, lifelong friend, Clay Johnson, whose background in business management — he had held executive positions at firms ranging from Neiman Marcus to Frito-Lay — served him well in this role. He had become the governor's executive director, equivalent to chief of staff, once Joe Albaugh had moved over to manage the presidential effort. Before that, he'd been the appointments director during most of Bush's governorship, overseeing the nearly 3,000 appointments to boards and commissions that a Texas governor makes. Johnson was able to do the transition planning discreetly, unbeknownst to the media and the public, and on a separate track from the campaign. The decision to start the transition planning early, with Clay in charge, proved highly beneficial, particularly given the extended election period. In large part because of Clay's detailed planning, the president and his team hit the ground running and got off to a successful early presidency. Clay later served as the White House personnel director and currently is deputy director for management at the Office of Management and Budget. One feature of contemporary politics had a profound impact on the transition, probably without Clay Johnson's intention or awareness, since he was neither a creature of politics nor had a background in it. I'm referring to the permanent campaign, a shorthand term for the way political leaders today work 365 days a year, year in and year out, to shape and manipulate sources of public approval as the primary means for governing. Because of the power and ubiquity of the permanent campaign, the jockeying for power during the 2000 presidential race did not end with the inauguration, but simply morphed into a different phase. Governance. I don't believe that any of Bush's senior advisors took time during the transition period to read and absorb the lessons offered in the book, The Permanent Campaign and Its Future. I know I didn't. If they had, they might have taken steps to minimize the impact of the permanent campaign and prevent some of the problems that plagued Bush at defining moments of his presidency. Instead, the permanent campaign was firmly ensconced in the Bush White House from the beginning, virtually guaranteeing that it would play a major role in the administration. Edited by a pair of respected scholars at two influential Washington think tanks, Norman J. Ornstein of the conservative-oriented American Enterprise Institute and Thomas E. Mann of the liberal-leaning Brookings Institution, the permanent campaign was published in June 2000, partly in the hope it would help guide future presidents-elect and their teams as they plan their transition into office. For me, it elucidates one of the core phenomena of today's Washington. As the preface to the book explains, when the phrase was first coined, perhaps in 1976 by Pat Caddell, an assistant to Jimmy Carter, the permanent campaign referred to the process of governing in a way that builds and sustains public support for an administration and its policies. In this sense, continual political campaigning is the means by which any administration exerts a lasting impact on the nation, since policies that the public doesn't understand or support are likely to be short-lived and ineffective. However, the meaning of the term and the excessive way the permanent campaign is practiced have evolved in a disturbing direction. As government professor Hugh Hecklow explains in the first chapter of Ornstein and Mann's book, today's permanent campaign is a nonstop process seeking to manipulate sources of public approval to engage in the act of governing itself. In other words, campaigning and governing have now become indistinguishable. The aim of Ornstein and Mann's book, as Hecklow notes, is to make sense of this new meaning of the permanent campaign, to understand how and why it has evolved, to weigh its consequences for our ability to govern ourselves effectively, and to consider whether steps might be taken to ameliorate its more damaging effects. Understanding the permanent campaign's impact on governing, both in the White House and Congress, is integral to grasping how Washington has gone astray, becoming ensnared in constant partisan bickering and warfare, and in particular, how the presidency of George W. Bush wandered and remains so far off course by excessively embracing the permanent campaign and its tactics. The permanent campaign is a concept that would have baffled our nation's founders. When they created our system of representative democracy as enshrined in the Constitution, Hecklow notes, they envisioned an ideal system of governance in which disinterested legislators and high-minded executives would determine policy free from interest group pressures and partisan loyalties. They assumed that members of Congress would be citizen statesmen, serving their country a few months each year and tending their farms, businesses, or professions the rest of the time. They considered parties pernicious and hoped they would never become a feature of the American system. The word party doesn't even appear in the Constitution. They deliberately provided that senators and presidents would not be chosen by popular vote, but rather by elites in the state legislatures and the Electoral College. If that insulated them from public opinion, so much the better. In much of 18th century discourse, the people were the mob, a collection of ill-informed, emotional, self-interested individuals who could not be trusted with high affairs of state. The idea of running the government to cater to this mob would have horrified men like Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, and Adams. Today, of course, the game of politics has been dramatically redefined. The people are more deeply and directly involved in government than ever before. In many ways, this is a very good thing. Certainly, government is more responsive to the needs of the citizens than it was in the 18th century. But some of the ways in which the desires of the people, however defined, are reflected in governance are dubious at best. We all know many of the problems. Narrowly tailored partisan and other special interest groups influence Congress to shape policies for the benefit of their members, not necessarily the citizenry as a whole. Opinion polling is used not only to read the mood of the electorate and guide political leaders in the ways they communicate their messages, but also, at times, to determine the policies they will advocate. Continuous fundraising, a necessity in an era when expensive television advertising and other costly forms of communication are essential for political success, binds powerful interest groups and wealthy donors to parties and politicians in a way that often shuts out the needs of the average American. In this new system, governing is primarily focused, in Heckler's phrase, on manipulating sources of public approval, using such tools as the news media, political blogs, popular websites, paid advertising, talk radio, local organizations, and propaganda disseminated by interest groups to shape narratives to one's advantage. In the age of the permanent campaign, governing becomes an offshoot of campaigning rather than the other way around. Bills at times are written as much to create talking points for boosting one's own party and embarrassing the opposition as they are to improve the operations of government or to promote justice. Presidential initiatives, from health care programs to foreign invasions, are regularly devised, named, timed, and launched with one eye, or both eyes, on the electoral calendar. Budgets are drawn up not solely with the pressing needs of the public at the forefront, but rather to reward political loyalists, punish enemies, and win votes in contested districts and states when November rolls around. The infiltration of politics into governance has been a feature of democracy from the beginning, but during the second half of the 20th century, it became increasingly prominent and pervasive. The administration of Richard Nixon, the first president to begin institutionalizing a permanent political operation inside the White House, exemplified many of the pitfalls of the permanent campaign, with its enemies list, its abuse of the IRS and the Justice Department for political ends, and the dirty tricks associated with the Watergate affair, which ultimately destroyed the administration. Too much of the permanent campaign mentality can cripple an administration. It brought down the Nixon presidency and nearly ended Clinton's, despite or because of what Washington Post media reporter Howard Kurtz called its spin doctors and well-oiled propaganda machine. And as I'll show in this book, it severely damaged the Bush White House, which arguably embraced and institutionalized the permanent campaign even more deeply than its predecessors. A second force shaping today's political environment is the perpetual scandal culture, which was born as the permanent campaign was growing deep roots in Washington. This is a lasting legacy of the Nixon presidency, as described by Bob Woodward, one of the dogged young journalists who exposed the cover-ups orchestrated by the Nixon White House. Woodward gave an authoritative account of the scandal's culture effect on succeeding presidents from Ford to Clinton in his book Shadow. As Woodward explains, Watergate created a deep distrust of the White House and a more cynical view of politics. Obvious questions arose. Could another president engage in criminal conduct? Did every president secretly plot behind closed doors as Nixon had done? A scandal-based cottage industry was born, including emboldened congressional inquisitors, investigative reporters, and determined prosecutors and ethics investigators. The habit of deception and hedging practiced by presidents would no longer be acceptable, writes Woodward. However, the endless investigations haven't ended deception in Washington, but rather turned it into just another part of an elaborate warlike game with operatives on both sides of the aisle and both inside and outside of government. Surprisingly, Woodward notes, none of Nixon's successors has managed to fully comprehend the depth of the distrust he left behind. Controversies significant and not so significant were allowed to grow legs in this less trusting environment of inquisition, some turning into notorious and enduring scandals. There was Ford's withholding all details of the deal he believed he had rejected to pardon Nixon, Carter's Burt Lance controversy, Reagan's Iran-Contra scandal, and the defeat of Robert Bork's nomination, and the elder Bush's involvement in Iran-Contra, in the loop or out of the loop, and a series of lesser controversies, from Passportgate and the John Tower nomination to the alleged involvement of Bush's own son, Neil, in the savings and loan scandal. Finally, there was a seemingly endless string of controversies and scandals that ensnared Clinton, from Whitewater to Lewinsky. Each of these presidents, Woodward concludes, had failed to heed the two fundamental lessons of Watergate. First, if there is questionable activity, release the facts, whatever they are, as early and completely as possible. Second, do not allow outside inquiries, whether conducted by prosecutors, congressmen, or reporters, to harden into a permanent state of suspicion and warfare. Inevitably, as these lessons went unheeded and the controversies and scandals took on lives of their own, lasting suspicion and partisan combat resulted, undermining each presidency to some degree. The presidents fueled the controversies, by not addressing them openly and directly, fueling a cycle of payback and retribution as congressional leaders of both parties sought to shape public opinion to their own advantage. The result was the creation of a destructive culture of endless scandal. My experience and involvement in politics leads me to conclude that presidents and their inner circles have in fact learned some of the wrong lessons. They've taken a cynical approach to dealing with the scandal culture. Fear of short-term political embarrassment leads them to reflexively manipulate, hide, and distort the truth. Top presidential advisors come to view their job as protecting the president above all else. They create a wall of protection around the Oval Office, making sure the president is sufficiently detached from, and preferably unaware of, the more unsavory side of politics. When controversy arises, they convince the president to embrace defensive tactics. This invariably cedes control of a president's reputation to outside investigations and allows the scandal machine to set the terms of a controversy's duration. What did the president know and when did he know it becomes the central question. But ironically, by seeking to protect themselves, presidents damage their honor and integrity and often put their presidency in jeopardy. The answer is not to get rid of the advisors and lawyers who seek to protect the president from the taint of scandal. The answer, as I'll explain in detail later in this book, is more principled presidential leadership. A third core element of the bitterly partisan Washington environment, one that is part and parcel of the current excessive embrace of the permanent campaign and the deep-seated scandal culture, is the increasingly ruthless, win-at-all-cost attitude that guides many politicians and their advisors in governing to manipulate public approval to their advantage. The philosophy of politics as war. The emergence of the permanent campaign and the scandal culture was bound to lead to growing animosity between the parties. What caused it to spill over into the all-out ideological wars of the 1990s were a series of historic turning points. Even before Watergate, as Lanny Davis, the former special counsel to President Clinton, persuasively argues, the culture wars of the 1960s helped launch the trend. In his book, Scandal, Davis talks of the true believers of the new right who began to dominate the National Republican Party in 1964. They viewed liberals as cultural enemies who were traitors to American values and who needed to be destroyed. The same period saw the emergence of the ideological purist of the new left. They embraced radical politics and frightened middle America with the rhetoric of revolution, which they used to express their anger over Vietnam, race, and mainstream culture in general. Both the New Right and New Left took their hardline ideologies far beyond what traditional conservative and liberal standard bearers had advocated. As Davis writes, the result was that by the end of the 1960s and the 1972 presidential election, both parties were in danger of domination by ideological purists who had personalized their political differences into hatred and vitriol. A dangerous new symmetry had set into the American political culture. For both the new left and new right, it was not enough to defeat the political opposition and criticize their policies. It was necessary to destroy the opposition and describe their policies as evil. The cycle of attack and payback, rooted in the high-profile controversies and scandals that followed Watergate, were further defining moments, Davis suggests. The tearing down of Burt Lance, Jimmy Carter's budget director, was in part Republicans' revenge for Watergate. The defeat of Supreme Court nominee Robert Bork through negative attacks and leaks was a big win for Democrats. Republicans came back with a fury during the Clinton years. The cycle showed no signs of stopping. Davis, a Democrat, focuses on the Bork episode, calling it the keystone event that triggered the most vicious subsequent manifestations of the scandal culture and gotcha politics. The issue is not whether there were legitimate reasons for opposing Bork's taking a seat on our nation's highest court. Liberals and experts in constitutional law raised legitimate philosophical concerns and questions about whether Bork had a suitable temperament for the Supreme Court, all of which warranted rational debate. But as Davis notes, the tactics used for defeating Bork crossed a line. Misinformation, distorted accusations, and self-serving leaks for political gain, all part of the unsavory side of today's politics, played a huge role in derailing the Bork nomination. Liberals leading the effort probably justified their tactics as necessary, simply the rules of Washington, the politics as war mentality. But conservatives were left fuming and would not forget the underhanded way liberals brought Bork down, even coining a new verb for the vicious attack strategy, borking. In looking back, I think another significant turning point was the 1988 presidential campaign. No campaign was more single-mindedly centered on bringing down an opponent than that of George Herbert Walker Bush. With their candidate trailing badly in the polls, his political strategists believed he could not win through an honest debate on the real issues. Instead, they developed a calculated strategy to go negative that had little to do with building their candidate up and everything to do with tearing their opponent, Michael Dukakis, down. The campaign was, by most objective accounts, full of distortions, misrepresentations, and zero-sum politics, accusing Dukakis of everything from embracing furloughs for dangerous criminals to disliking the Pledge of Allegiance, the innuendo being that he was unpatriotic. It was, as recorded in The Quest for the Presidency, by Peter and Tom Matthews Goldman, the systematic dismemberment of Michael Dukakis, based on a scorched-earth strategy. The elder Bush certainly believed in civility and decency. Everything about his record and his personal behavior indicates that, and he is one of the most decent and honorable men I have ever met. But during the 1988 campaign, he acquiesced to certain advisors, including Roger Ailes and the late Lee Atwater, who were intent on winning at all cost, within the bounds of legality. I'm sure that many conservatives viewed it as part of the game and necessary for achieving the right end, but the blood left on the pavement at the end of the one-sided and mean-spirited political street brawl between Bush and Dukakis spilled into the corridors of Congress. The controversies and scandals that engulfed the 41st president's White House were motivated at least in part by the desire to exact retribution for what he'd wrought in his campaign. These were the new rules by which politics as war would now be practiced by Democrats and Republicans alike. By 1992, Clinton and his political advisors felt they had learned the lessons of the 1988 campaign, answer every attack, counter misrepresentations, and distortions of one's record by using the same tactics against the opponent, play by the same rules the opposition plays by, but do it better. Beginning with the 1992 election campaign, the Clinton political machine became famous for its aggressive pushback tactics, its subtle and not-so-subtle intimidation of reporters, its mastery of spin, and its rapid response to charges. An admiring documentary film, The War Room, made Clinton operatives George Stephanopoulos and James Carville media stars as it showed the world how a canny, tough-minded campaign team could control the news cycle and help shape the attitudes of millions of people, for good or ill. Which party shares more blame for the ascendancy of the politics as war philosophy? That is an interesting question that would likely require a lengthy book to dissect. One thing is certain, the philosophy of politics as war has been developing for decades, and elected leaders of both parties bear responsibility for it. Some put the primary responsibility at the media's doorstep. I don't. The media has its problems, and the most notable for me is its complicity in encouraging ideological combat to flourish because of its insatiable appetite for something or someone to pick on. But our elected leaders have the greatest power and highest responsibility to do something about it, and I think that is what most Americans want and expect them to do. Instead, most have chosen the more destructive route of practicing politics as war in order to achieve their short-term political goals. During the era of the Clinton presidency and Gingrich Republicanism, the permanent campaign, the perpetual scandal culture, and politics as war coalesced as never before. The result was all-out partisan warfare. I only have to mention some of the lowlights of that era to remind you of how it demoralized and repulsed the citizenry, halted progress on addressing our national problems, and dragged the reputation of Washington in the mud. Vince Foster, Whitewater, Travelgate, Filegate, the Gingrich government shutdown, Paula Jones, Monica Lewinsky, Wag the Dog, and the Mark Rich pardon. What a roster of national embarrassments, some substantive, some not, all fueled by two factors: the White House's lack of candor and honesty, and the partisan determination to destroy political enemies no matter what the cost. By the time of the 2000 election, the permanent campaign and its attendant ills had become status quo for the Clinton team, Congress, and Washington. The Clinton White House came to epitomize the style of governing via endless campaign, institutionalizing it as never before. It was the accepted way of doing things. Most people involved in governing and campaigns understood that political manipulation was a necessary part of how things are done, particularly in a climate of partisan war. They gave little thought to its overall effect on national politics, beyond occasional hand-wringing complaints and ineffectual sighs about the good old days. The national media became complicit enablers as the 24-hour news networks jumped on every scandal and conflict, no matter how trivial, to fill airtime, stir the pot of controversy, and attract viewers. Political news came to resemble sports coverage, with its entertaining plays of the week, instant analysis, constant anointing of winners, losers, heroes, and goats. Many pundits did not dedicate themselves to dispassionate analysis, but cheered on one side and shouted down the other. And when partisan warfare breaks out on such a large scale, the results are terribly destructive and do lasting damage to our national political discourse. Vicious, negative attacks, distortions, spin, unsubstantiated innuendo, and misinformation become the norm. The headlines and sound bites that receive the greatest emphasis in the media too often are grounded in such unsavoriness. Caveats are de-emphasized, contradictory information is downplayed, dismissed, or simply disregarded. Complex issues are too often oversimplified in the context of winners and losers and portrayed in stark black and white terms. The side that most effectively manipulates the narrative often prevails and is lifted up as being on the offensive, at times regardless of any nuances in the larger underlying truth. Deception nudges truth to the side. I believe most of those engaging in the deceptive ways on both sides of the partisan aisle, including our elected leaders, are good people who have fallen prey to the destructive nature of the Washington game. But as manipulation is embraced more widely and becomes more accepted, a new culture starts to develop as a result of the all-out partisan warfare, a culture of deception. Sun Tzu, an ancient Chinese general, is known for his military treatise, The Art of War, written centuries before the birth of Christ. It is one of the oldest and most widely read books in existence on military strategy. It has also made a lasting imprint on business leadership and political campaigns for its strategic insights. I can't remember which political strategist first recommended the book to me years ago, but one relevant passage in the book notes that all warfare is based on deception. The Art of War goes on to discuss the many ways of employing deception when preparing for battle, ways not unlike those that might be useful for winning a campaign for elected office or exercising power when in office. Sun Tzu even points out that effective military strategy includes deceiving not just the enemy, but one's own troops as well, making them follow orders without full knowledge of their leader's true intentions. In warfare, the goal is to literally destroy the enemy. Using deception in this context is probably reasonable, since damaging relationships is a small price to pay when a life and death struggle for survival is involved. In politics, there may be a few limited, minor instances where deception is acceptable. For example, when a campaign pretends to be more active early in the process than it really is, in order to trick the other campaign into spending money and resources too early. But applying the strategy of deception broadly to politics and governance is a step too far. Unfortunately, the Sun Tzu approach has become the norm in politics, as deception is considered vital today for defeating campaign opponents and for governing. This all's fair attitude now permeates political campaigns and has crossed excessively into governing, especially when the stakes are high. Washington, as a result, has become a breeding ground for deception and a killing field for truth. Make no mistake, governing inevitably has an adversarial element. People and groups will always differ about the proper use of limited government resources. But should government be a process of constant campaigning to manipulate public opinion rather than one centered as much as possible on rational debate, deliberation, and compromise? Should it be based on all-out war and deception, or grounded in a high level of openness, forthrightness, honesty, and a search for truth? All too often, in today's politics, the spirit of warfare rules. Clinton and his team played the game extremely well. They showed an uncanny resilience and ability to persevere and prevail in the high-stakes political combat of attack and counterattack. In the end, Bill Clinton's undeniable personal flaws proved to be debilitating, but not fatal to his presidency. Why? Because Clinton had a magnetic personality, extraordinary charisma, and a rare ability to charm many Americans, as well as a deep appreciation, whether based on principle or political pragmatism, for governing toward the center. He succeeded on the policy front, enlisting Republican support and enacting policies that middle America cared about, from welfare reform to deficit reduction. He understood that a successful agenda can overcome personal shortcomings and partisan ill will. His team knew that their greatest persuader was Clinton himself, and they knew how to play the Washington game of the permanent campaign better than any previous White House. But their excessive embrace of the modern-day rules, shared by the Gingrich Republicans, came at a heavy price to the nation. Unfortunately, the incoming Bush administration learned some of the wrong lessons from watching the Clinton White House. As they planned for the new regime in Washington, they did nothing to change the status quo. Rather than thinking outside of the box of the permanent campaign, they accepted the new rules of the game and focused on how to play it better, not how to change the game to one that would better serve the American people. Ironically, much of Bush's campaign rhetoric had been aimed at distancing himself from the excesses of Clinton's permanent campaign style of governing. The implicit meaning of Bush's words was that he would bring an end to the perpetual politicking and the deep partisan divisions it created. Although Washington could not get enough of the permanent campaign, voters were seemingly eager to move beyond it. Bush emphasized this sentiment during the campaign. He would change the tone in Washington. He would be a uniter, not a divider. He would restore honor and dignity to the White House. He would govern based on what was right, not what the polls said. He would, in short, replace the cynicism of the 1990s with a new era of civility, decency, and hope. There would be no more permanent campaign, or at least its excesses would be wiped away for good. But the reality proved to be something quite different. Instead, the Bush team imitated some of the worst qualities of the Clinton White House and even took them to new depths. Bush did not emulate Clinton on the policy front. Just the opposite. The mantra of the new administration was anything but Clinton when it came to policies. The Bush administration prided itself in focusing on big ideas, not playing small ball with worthy but essentially trivial policy ideas for a White House, like introducing school uniforms or going after deadbeat dads. But a significant aspect of the Clinton presidency that George W. Bush and his advisors did embrace was the unprecedented pervasiveness of the permanent campaign and all its tactics. In hindsight, it is clear that the Bush White House was actually structured to emulate and extend this method of governing, albeit in its own way. The most obvious evidence that the Bush White House embraced the permanent campaign is the expansive political operation that was put in place from day one. Chief political strategist Karl Rove was given an enormous center of influence within the White House from the outset. This was only strengthened by Rove's force of personality and closeness to the president. He would be one of the three key players, along with Karen Hughes and Andy Card, beyond the president himself, who most defined the way the Bush White House operated. I first started getting to know Karl in 1992 when I was managing a Texas State Senate campaign that hired his political consulting firm to do direct mail. My conversations with him during that period were not extensive. He had plenty of other clients to tend to, and his work for us was primarily limited to the mailings. But Rove already was establishing himself as the guru of Republican politics in Texas. A couple of years earlier, in 1990, while the Republican gubernatorial nominee I worked for narrowly went down in defeat, two Rove clients on the statewide ballot, Kay Bailey Hutchison and Rick Perry, had won races for treasurer and agriculture commissioner respectively, winning Rove some of his early renown as a rising political star in the state. After the state Senate campaign in Northwest Texas, which we lost ever so narrowly against an entrenched incumbent, I moved back to Austin to figure out my next move. I had some time on my hands and volunteered to help on Hutchison's nascent campaign for the U.S. Senate. It was a special election to replace Lloyd Benson, who had become Treasury Secretary. Hutchison would challenge the incumbent, Bob Krueger, previously Texas Railroad Commissioner, who had been appointed by the governor to serve until a replacement could be elected. The fledgling campaign was operating out of Rove's office space at the outset. I was helping make calls to get people to show up for Hutchison's upcoming 4-day 20-city announcement tour. Just as Hutchison was to begin the tour, her campaign manager asked if I would travel with her for the first day. At the time, Rove had already given my name to some communication strategists from a D.C. firm who were seeking talent to help one of their clients, the American Tort Reform Association, with its lawsuit reform efforts in Texas. But the thought of traveling with someone who could be the next U.S. Senator from Texas sounded like a good experience, so I quickly agreed. The day of travel turned into 4 full days on a small plane with Hutchison and her husband, Ray. It was great fun, and at the end of the tour, I was offered a paid position on the campaign. But at the same time, I was offered a job working on the lawsuit reform effort. In part, since I had just finished a campaign, I was not sure jumping into another competitive race was something I was ready to do, so I accepted the lawsuit reform position. I would not have gotten the job had Rove not suggested my name. Rove was becoming the dominant force in Texas politics. He was viewed by many political observers in the state as a fierce competitor who at times could be ruthless and vicious, operating with a take-no-prisoners mentality. I stayed in contact with Carl sporadically over the next few years. In 1994, his company did some work for my mother's election to the Railroad Commission, which regulated the Texas oil and gas industry, the first statewide campaign I managed. But that year, he was mainly focused on Bush's gubernatorial campaign. Texas had already been trending Republican, and Rove engineered a Republican sweep of all statewide executive offices in 1998. I remember election night well. My mother had been in one of the more closely contested races, and many pundits rated her chances against the incumbent as poor. But we pulled off the upset and helped ensure the Republican sweep. All the Republican candidates were holding their individual victory parties at the same hotel in downtown Austin, the Capitol Marriott. Our room was a few steps from the main ballroom where the Bush campaign was celebrating. Later in the evening, as it was starting to become apparent that my mother would also win, Rove appeared at her party. I was sitting in a cordoned-off area just to the right of the door, where we had tables and computers set up to monitor the votes as they came in. In a loud and energized voice, Rove said, "I want to congratulate the person responsible for this victory, and there he is," he added as he turned to the right and pointed to me. "She could not have won without you, buddy. You did a fabulous job." This was heady praise for a 26-year-old. Here was the top Republican political strategist in the state and the new kingmaker of Texas politics, going out of his way to offer words of validation. We shook hands and embraced. "I don't know that it was me, but thanks," I said. "Your words mean a lot, and I appreciate them very much." Rove was the go-to guy in Texas for young politicos such as myself. If you wanted to get a political job in Republican politics, Rove was at the top of the list of people to visit, and despite his busy schedule, he was always generous with advice and help. Many younger operatives in Texas considered themselves dedicated followers of Rove and his school of politics. I never really felt that way. I always viewed myself as a more independent political operative, one who was not necessarily tied to any one strategist or camp within the Texas Republican Party. But I knew that Rove was the kingmaker in Texas Republican politics, and I appreciated and welcomed his support. After I joined Bush's team in 1999, I would see Carl occasionally at a senior staff meeting in the governor's office. By the time I moved over to the campaign, months later, I would see him frequently in the hallways of our campaign headquarters in downtown Austin, especially after I became traveling press secretary. When not on the road, I would attend the daily message meeting of senior aides, which Carl also attended, and frequently he would join us on the campaign trail. I came to know Carl even better when I joined him on the senior White House staff. I will always recall fondly how Carl inserted his brand of levity into the demanding, draining life inside the White House bubble. He has an endearing, goofy side that he used to boost morale, especially during the rigors of an election campaign, when every day in another hotel felt like yet another Groundhog Day. Toward the end of the 2004 election campaign, for instance, Carl used to rev up his fellow Bush team passengers in the staff vans by loudly leading us in some of the famous chants from the Republican convention in New York that August. He would just start yelling, "USA, USA, 4 more years, 4 more years, or one of our favorites, "Flip, flop, flip, flop." You may remember the large flip-flop beach sandals that conventioners waved to symbolize John Kerry's tendency to change his position on issues. I would usually follow right along, and others would join in at times. I think sometimes our volunteer driver, usually a local supporter, would wonder whether Carl had been on the road too long or needed to get out of the sun. I'm sure many an onlooker must have wondered, is this the famous political genius? In the 2000 campaign, I remember hanging out late on election night in Carl's campaign office. Several other aides were in his office or nearby. Carl was working the phones, checking emails, and crunching numbers from the Florida counties. He had been energized by the way the networks had earlier called Florida for Gore, only to reverse themselves. Carl had been going around headquarters saying that conservative precincts in the Florida panhandle were still voting and that the closeness elsewhere made the network projections premature. Now, after their reversal, Carl seemed emboldened and determined, almost as if his sheer willpower was magically turning things in our direction. Shortly after 1 a.m., Fox News became the first network to project a Bush win in Florida, and with it, a victory in the national election. This was a thrilling development, but like others, I stayed silent, not sure whether to believe it, and watching to see whether Carl and his usually spot-on number crunching agreed. but a few nail-biting minutes later, the other networks followed suit, reversing their earlier projections. The euphoria could not be contained. The other staffers and I let out enthusiastic yells, raised our arms, and high-fived one another. Rove led staffers who had remained behind at campaign headquarters to follow results in a march down Congress Avenue in Austin to the front of the state capitol. Bush was supposed to appear there, but later results caused the networks to reverse course again and say it was too close to call, and Gore withdrew his congratulatory call. Carl is without a doubt one of the brightest political talents of our time, thanks to his boundless energy and enthusiasm, his deep historical knowledge, and his keen insights into the electorate. He is a sharp strategic thinker and a savvy, shrewd, and devious strategist. Carl lives, eats, and breathes politics, and he loves everything that comes with it, particularly the competition and verbal combat. To him, politics is a contact sport, and he relishes the partisan warfare. Carl also has a reputation as a ruthless, perhaps unscrupulous operator, and has always struck me as the kind of person who would be willing, in the heat of battle, to push the envelope to the limit of what is permissible ethically or legally. Rove likes to have his hands in just about everything, relishing policy shaping as much as political strategizing. He views governing and politics as completely interconnected, and he occupied a key seat at the center of both in Bush's White House. Named senior advisor to the president just weeks before the inauguration, Rove was charged with overseeing politics and political strategy, and he headed four key offices aimed at one overarching objective: shaping and manipulating sources of public opinion, much as in a political campaign, to help advance the Bush agenda and policies. Each office was influential in its own right, and combined under Rove, they formed a massive, powerful operation that would drive a campaign-like effort to strengthen the president's standing with the public, as measured by his all-important approval ratings. And they often did so very effectively. The Office of Strategic Initiatives served primarily as a long-range strategic planning outfit. This office hadn't existed in previous administrations. My sense is that it built on and consolidated into one operation a number of equivalent functions carried out by previous White House staffs. But in its current form, it was Rove's grand creation. This office looked weeks and months down the road, planning the president's public focus in terms of his policies and agenda. But it also stayed integrally involved in day-to-day White House operations, sending a staffer to attend most key meetings. It also routinely engaged in research, monitored polling data, coordinated key strategy meetings, and daily played an integral role in helping the president set his agenda. The Office of Political Affairs coordinated a broad range of politically oriented events and activities, keeping in close contact with the Republican National Committee and with Republican leaders and activists in states and communities around the nation. It was also responsible for preparing detailed political briefing papers for Bush's trips to various states and localities, including an overview of each state's political climate, demographic characteristics, noteworthy issues, recent election results, media markets, congressional delegations, state leaders, and GOP party leaders, and a summary of previous visits to the state by Bush and his cabinet members. In effect, it prepared an information kit that provided the president an instant overview of the political context for anything he would say or do during a visit, making it easier for him to couch his message appropriately for a particular setting. The Office of Public Liaison worked closely with key constituencies and public interest groups, from trade associations like the Chamber of Commerce, to groups like National Right to Life, to African-American leaders and organizations. Staffers were assigned various constituencies, business groups, social conservative organizations, Hispanic outreach, and many others. Public Liaison helped mobilize such constituencies as needed to advance important priorities and manage their meetings with the president. Sometimes its job was to neutralize a group, attempting to dissuade an influential organization from openly opposing an initiative that might cause consternation for its members. An example might be keeping a group that represents the elderly from openly opposing personal or private retirement accounts for younger workers during the Social Security debate of 2005, using the argument that future reforms would not impact any currently retired people. The Office of Intergovernmental Affairs focused on state and local officials. It coordinated closely with mayors, county commissioners, governors, and other state officials on policy, presidential meetings in Washington, and visits to localities. Individuals of enormous political savvy and intellect headed each of the four offices throughout President Bush's time in office. Each also had an energetic staff of up-and-comers to help develop and execute various strategies, duties, and initiatives. The director of each office reported directly to Rove and worked under his direction and guidance. The existence of these four powerful political offices inside the White House, most established prior to Bush's presidency, helped solidify the place of the permanent campaign in the national political landscape. The concept of politics as war was reinforced by the sharply partisan approach to both campaigning and governing that Karl Rove practiced and taught. Rove tended to look at everything from the political viewpoint, particularly the impact on core constituencies. He saw the electorate as divided more sharply along partisan lines than ever before in recent history, and he felt it was absolutely essential to keep the party base of social, economic, and foreign policy conservatives happy and solidly in support of the president. Having a solid conservative base of support and not alienating the party faithful, in Karl's view, would allow the president then to reach out to independents and swing Democratic voters to maintain a majority in the country of at least 50% plus one. As distinguished from the broad majority political strategy of consistently governing from the center and not catering too heavily to single issue or narrowly focused partisan constituencies, the 50% plus one strategy emphasizes catering to ideological purists. For example, Bush appeased social conservatives by forcefully advocating passage of a constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage as we headed to Election Day in 2004. On another occasion, he dramatically returned to Washington in the middle of the night from his home in Crawford to sign a federal law transferring the fate of Terri Schiavo to the federal courts, thereby involving the national government in a controversial issue typically handled by the states. Bush's decision in 2001 to narrowly limit the federal government's role in embryonic stem cell research and his later vetoing of legislation expanding it kept social conservatives appeased too, as did his support for legislation to ban partial birth abortion. Each move to the right garnered enormous coverage in the media and did much to shape public perceptions of the Bush administration. Regardless of the merits of these issues, Bush's emphasis on them created a perception of a president who was focusing on ideologically rigid issues tailored to a single-issue constituency, pro-lifers, rather than addressing pressing priorities that the broad majority in the center, center, center-right, and center-left, cared most about, such as the economy, healthcare, energy, and the environment. Rove had enormous influence in putting these issues front and center on the president's public agenda. It was a far cry from Bush's days as governor of Texas, when he consistently governed from the center and avoided overemphasizing controversial issues embraced by single-issue, socially conservative constituencies, and that tend to pit groups of people against one another. Washington is a much different political environment than Texas was when Bush led it. More is expected from the ideological purists who represent partisan base organizations and the opinion leaders who influence the same constituencies. Rove and Bush both recognized this. By keeping the social conservatives happy with initiatives like the ones mentioned here, passing substantial tax cuts, which kept the economic base happy, and taking a hardline, confrontational approach on national security, which pleased the hawks, Bush could have greater liberty to push centrist policies on immigration, public education, and Medicare prescription drug coverage. It was a strategy that worked well in the first term and helped Bush get reelected. But its shortcomings and flaws were exposed in the second term as Bush's Iraq policy began to cripple his presidency. When things started deteriorating in Iraq, Bush and Rove knew it was politically impossible for him to appear as if he was backing away from his vision for a free and democratic Iraq, even by a single iota. If he did, they knew his base would see him as weak and begin to fracture. Under this base strategy, compromising on an acceptable outcome that Democratic and Republican congressional leaders could support was essentially out of the question and never seriously contemplated. Add the excessive public catering to social conservatives, and Bush's problems and his poor standing with the public are exacerbated even more. Having a brilliant political strategist and grand manipulator of sources of public approval like Rove working in the White House isn't necessarily a problem in itself. It's a problem, however, when political strategy takes over excessively and governance becomes merely a subset of campaigning, and when the strategist is someone with the skills, personality, and reach of Karl Rove, It's all too easy for that to happen. He liked to have his hands involved in, if not controlling, anything and everything that could affect Bush's approval ratings. Sometimes he worked quietly behind the scenes. Other times he asserted himself in meetings. Generally speaking, on most policy and strategic decisions, and particularly on campaigns to sell policy to the public, his views were given great weight and deference. Rove was specifically excluded from National Security Council war meetings. Obviously, the presence of the controversial Rove in those meetings would have given critics a field day. But his exclusion in itself seems to raise the question of why there was not equal concern about whether politics unduly affected policy considerations in the otherwise almost all-encompassing role in governing Rove played. Within the Bush administration, Rove's controlling personality and substantial influence over policy, strategy, political communications, and message expanded unchecked, particularly after the departure of Karen Hughes, another strong personality and a key member of the Bush troika of advisors. Karen represented a second sphere of influence created at the beginning of the administration. She, too, was a longtime trusted Bush aide from Texas. The president sought her advice and input and usually agreed with it. I recall a conversation in the early days when I was traveling with him, sans Karen. He was asking how I liked working for her. During the conversation, he said, "Karen gets it right most of the time. Not all the time, but most of the time she is right." Bush's trust in Karen and her closeness to him, her dynamic personality, her savvy strategic thinking, and her ability to grasp the views of middle America made her, like Rove, an instrumental player in all aspects of the White House, including policy. Of course, her designated role, overseeing the large White House communications apparatus, which in today's politics plays an ever more prominent role in the permanent campaign, was very important in itself. My first experience with Karen was back in the early 1990s, when she was executive director of the Texas Republican Party. She was looking for a finance director to oversee the organization's fundraising. Although I was not really interested in working for the state party, and my experience was not in fundraising, I was encouraged to explore the possibility, and my name had been suggested to her as an up-and-coming political operative. For a 23-year-old, it could be another way to establish